It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, welcome back to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can find all of the podcasts that Fox supports at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you'll subscribe, rate, and review this one. I also wanted to let you know that for the week of October 4th through the 8th, I'll be hosting Fox News Primetime again on the 7 o'clock hour on Fox News. If you have suggestions about topics or guests that you'd like me to talk to, you can email me at ben@thefederalist.com. Happy to take a look at your ideas on that front. Today I'm talking to a very interesting guest, Scott Adams, someone who may be familiar with you as the creator of the Dilbert comics originally, but someone who's become far better known in the time since for both his books and his writings on Twitter and his daily podcast, Coffee with Scott Adams, which you should subscribe to, that really takes a look at politics and American society from a very interesting and unique perspective. He's someone who I started paying attention to during the pandemic, as a lot of other people did, because he had a different perspective on the way things were going. And he talks a lot about persuasion and the power of it in terms of shifting the way that people perceive not just the dynamics of the world around them, but what reality actually is. He's an interesting guest and someone who I hope you will listen to and subscribe to across multiple channels, and you should get his books as well. Scott Adams, coming up next.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
Scott Adams, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I had started listening to your daily podcast, the Coffee Every Morning, during the pandemic, at the behest of a lot of people who were telling me from different walks of life that you had a very interesting take on things. You've been cited in the media a couple of different times for kind of being ahead of the curve on that point. What do you think it is about your own perspective, a unique perspective, I think, that let you in on what was going on before a lot of the quote unquote experts were really waking up to what was happening?
Well, I always talk about something called a talent stack, which is a set of talents that are not just good individually, but they work well together. And my talent stack includes psychology in terms of persuasion, hypnosis. I'm a trained hypnotist, and also economics. That's what my degree's in. So if you can follow the money, and you can also follow the psychology of people, you can often see around corners. So for example, when Fauci was first telling us that masks were no good, I immediately spotted that as a lie. Now that's separate from the question of whether masks work. All right, you can put that aside as a separate question, or whether they work well enough to be worth it. But it was obvious he was lying when he said it. And one of my skills is detecting lies. You know, it's actually a skill you can build. You can look for the tells. And that one never really made sense to me. As soon as I saw it, I called that out publicly as a lie. And then eventually he actually admitted they were lying. They were trying to conserve the supply. And which is also what I suspected, because I assumed there was a supply problem. Likewise, when we first heard about all the problems in China, I think I was one of the first one or two. I think Jack Posobiec was up there. Before the president closed travel, I was just screaming about it and swearing about it, you know, close the border, because whatever is going on there, the risk of closing the border temporarily just to figure it out is pretty low compared to whatever scary thing is coming toward us. And sure enough, the president eventually closed it. And honestly, I didn't even think that was a possibility. When I was saying we should close travel from China, I didn't know we could actually do that. I mean, I'd never even heard of it. But sure enough, we could. So I would say that between economics and the skill of persuasion, it gives me a little extra seeing around corner ability that's not genetic. It's just two things I've trained to do.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I didn't realize this before I started talking to you, but I'm sitting in my new office space surrounded by piles and piles of books that have to be organized to go on my shelves. And I'm realizing that the top of one of the stacks is Build a Better Life by Stealing Office Supplies. So, but it's funny to me to see, I think a lot of people would say, it's fine to say that Scott Adams has an interesting take on things, but he's still just the Dilbert guy, right? What does he have to bring such a, insight to the moment that we're living in? And yet when you listen to your podcast, it seems clear that you have this unique bundle of intelligence and perspective that is at a remove from the Acela corridor elites in a way that I think provides you a much better angle at taking on what's going on day to day than a lot of the people who you see regularly on cable news who are really caught within that tunnel vision.
I've got two advantages going on that maybe they don't. One is that since I'm a cartoonist by trade, simplification is what I do. I mean, that's my primary skill is simplification. So to the extent that I can communicate simply, it makes the message more effective. So that helps. But the other thing is I'm not closely aligned with a political side. Mm-hmm. Now, I talk most, and my audience is mostly conservative, but I tell them, often that I'm left of Bernie socially, but otherwise I just like what works, right? Mm-hmm. Things either work or they don't work, and Republicans often are better with systems. They'll build a system that understands human motivation, whereas Democrats will say, imagine everybody's nice, and then build a system around that. that just doesn't work.
One of the things that you weighed in on recently that I wanted to ask you about, where I'm not going to say that you changed your mind, but you'll take something and kind of do a thought experiment, and then you'll come back to it on a future episode and maybe redo that thought experiment or have a different take on it. And that's about the American military. You had this really interesting explanation, I think, for why when someone's in charge and they want to do something that the managers underneath them don't really want to do, then they'll throw up roadblocks. They'll try to make it not happen. And you use this in explaining what was going on potentially in Afghanistan. I thought that was a very interesting and true insight. I don't know if you recall it, but it's also one that seems to be notably absent from our political analysis if you turn on the TV.
Yeah, another one of my advantages is that having gone through two large corporate careers, I know how big organizations work, and they tend to work the same way everywhere. And one of the things that, to the point that you made there, is that everybody's worked for a big organization has seen situations where the boss gives a very clear order and the staff doesn't want to do it. So instead of saying no or yes, they'll slow roll it or slow walk it, is the phrase used. And they'll just make sure that they do everything, maybe even by the book. Because if you do things by the book, you can never get anything done. And so it's one way to kill a project you don't like is to follow all of the rules. And everybody in the corporate who has corporate experience knows that. Oh, yeah, all I have to do is follow the actual rules and I can stop anything. Yeah, you have to bend a rule to get anything done in corporate America. So it seemed to me that in the Milley case, Biden and Trump before that told people when to get out, and there may have been some resistance for a variety of reasons. Who knows what the reasons are? And there is some point at which the boss just has to say, all right, if you're going to make it messy, so my only choices are to get out messy or to not get out and then you're in charge. No, you're not in charge. I'm still the president of the damn United States. If the only way you can make it happen is messy, we're going to do it. Do it messy. And, I'm not saying any conversation like that happened, but that would be a typical thing you could expect in sort of a big organization. So to rule it out, I don't think there's any reason to rule it out. It seems like the most likely explanation in my view.
It seems like this observation that you have is increasingly relevant in an era in which we are essentially ruled by an unelected, you know, bureaucratic elite that really makes all the determinations, regardless of who's in office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That basically, you know, under Trump, they were basically trying to, as you say, do everything by the book, slow everything down, you know, take forever, make sure all the TPS reports are filed, and then end up in a situation where, you know, we just are trying to wait him out for 4 years. And with Biden, it seems that, you know, while they're rushing ahead in certain respects, you still have this problem of a unelected bureaucratic elite that doesn't have to go in front of the voters. And that really does decide, you know, in a regulation manner and everything else, how we live. We see this particularly not just at the federal level, but at the state level as well, with these, you know, determinations about the way people live, where you have to mask, what you have to do, and how children are taught in ways that I think a lot of people learned during the pandemic have a lot of significance in terms of what they can control about our lives. I'm not really someone who's comfortable with that. I don't find that to be a situation that's good for the country or for the people. And yet there doesn't seem to be a huge revolt against it, except perhaps in the realm of education, where people you know, seem to be very angry at teachers' unions and wanting to have more control over how their kids are taught. What do you think about that dynamic in America? Do you think that we've reached a point where we're willing to just be docile and go along with what the bureaucrats tell us to do? And has the pandemic changed that perspective for you on the way that Americans would like to live?
You know, I'm a total optimist when it comes to Americans, meaning American character and willingness to do the hard things. So when I see a situation which is presented to us as temporary by its nature, and I don't see a lot of pushback, then that makes me feel that people are being somewhat rational and reasonable and saying, okay, there will be a point. There will be a point, but it's not yet. So that feels like what the public is dealing with is, yes, there's going to be a point where we have to take this decision away from the government. And we will. We will take the decision away from the government. It only takes, 10% of people to revolt and you can't get anything done. So it's not like you need 70% of the public to turn all at once. You get 10%, and we're probably already at 5, mm-hmm. right? So you're always right on the base of the people taking control back. And the government doesn't really have the control of this and shouldn't. And I've argued that who makes the decision? Well, this is sort of the Thomas Sowell observation. Sometimes it's more important who makes the decision. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the government's incentive is to have zero deaths. Because that's how they'll be measured. They'll be measured by the number of deaths. They've got to minimize that at all costs because that's their job. But that's not my job. It's not mm-hmm. your job. We're citizens. My job is to do a calculation about my personal situation every day. Do I drive to work or is it too dangerous to get in that car? Mm-hmm. Right. So my decisions are completely different than a government's decision. And so the decision of how to handle the pandemic, you know, what risk is appropriate in schools, et cetera, it's in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. The government's not the right tool for that decision. The public is. And, you know, there's a weird balance now where certainly the government is looking to the public to know what it can get away with. But we're sort of already at the point where the public is taking control. And if mm-hmm. the public wanted, you know, just a few more percentage points of public wanting, let's say, masks to disappear in schools, it'll happen. So I don't think the public has ever given up control. I think that the public is not sure what it wants. The moment the public is sure what it wants, then the government has no control over anything. Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, I was disappointed that you didn't throw your hat in the ring against Gavin Newsom. so many other people did. You are a proud American and a proud Californian, but you have to critique your state for the way that it forces you to live with regularity. Is there any hope to fixing California? Or is this just kind of a lost cause where you're going to have to live with this level of not just, fire disaster, but regulatory requirements, and of course the burgeoning homelessness problem, which has chased so many people that I know out of the state. Is there any hope out there?
Well, I'm in a tough position being a California resident because I, of course, am looking at my options. And I've decided that California sucks in a lot of ways, especially recently, but it doesn't quite suck as much as those other places I might go to. So, we all have a different set of, what are your priorities? And there's still enough about California that you just can't get anywhere else, or you can't get it the same way, that it's just a tough decision. But I'm serious about it. I mean, certainly I've got my eyes open looking at other states. But yeah, it's a tough thing. And if you ask me, how's it going to get fixed? I don't think it could get fixed in the context of a one-party state. Mm-hmm. We're effectively a Democrat state. We don't have any real competition. So without competition, whatever got fixed? Name something that got fixed without competition. It's pretty tough.
The dominance of Gavin Newsom is being used by some Democrats across the country as an indication that a lockdown approach has been vindicated. That's not something that I agree with, but it is certainly something that has some appeal politically. Because it comes across as looking out for people's safety, or suggesting that you care more about people. What are your thoughts on that?
Sometimes the policy detail, which is the thing we tend to focus on, isn't really the thing that's driving anything. Mm-hmm. It's just a diversion, something to talk about. And with Gavin Newsom, I think he's got a couple of things going for him that are pretty strong. One is he's got the look. I don't think there's ever been a politician who had the look better. And if you think that doesn't matter, oh, that matters.
Oh, it matters.
But he's got that going for him. The second thing he's going for him is that, like it or not, whatever he did, it did register as strong leadership. Mm. Now, you could say, well, but he did the wrong things. And I would say, yeah, but he did them confidently. He did them confidently. And we weren't waiting around. I mean, I feel like, he was timely, he was decisive. And I said at the very beginning of the pandemic, and a bunch of times publicly after that, that personally, I'm going to go really easy on the mistakes that our leaders are going to make and have already made. So I said that in advance. They're going to make a lot of mistakes. We don't know what to do. People are going to try a bunch of stuff. We hope the stuff that works will encourage the people who did the wrong stuff to do the right stuff eventually. But it's going to be a whole bunch of people guessing. And if you think that the people who guessed right are the smart ones and the people who guessed wrong are the bad ones, you're just not sophisticated. Mm-hmm. that's just not what's happening. This is people guessing. Under that scenario, the people who guessed wrong, I just can't hold them to that standard. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for leadership. Did you make people think you had a plan? Did you try something? Did you adjust it when it wasn't working? Did you show confidence? Did you tell people it was under control, even if it wasn't? I think, I hate to say it, but Gavin Newsom, from a political perspective, just as a politician, mm-hmm. he's got a really strong package there. Whether he makes the right decisions, I think that's certainly up for debate. But he's just so dominant at this point. I don't think anything's going to stop him.
Here's my Gavin Newsom story. I've met him a couple of times, but I was on a plane flying to LA to be on Bill Maher's show several years ago. And across the aisle from me was a woman sitting next to Don Johnson, who I struck up a conversation with. Turns out, of course, it's his wife. And she asked me why I'm flying to California. I explained I'm going to be on Bill Maher, and she says, "Oh, who are the other guests we watch all the time?" And I said, "Oh, well, Gavin Newsom, who at that time was the lieutenant governor." And she said, "Oh, that's so funny. I used to date Gavin." And I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, he introduced me to Don." So the lesson of that is, no matter if you're like a handsome politician, do not under any circumstances introduce your girlfriend to Don Johnson, because he will steal your girl. you talk about persuasion a lot on your show. And I'm curious, why are so many politicians bad at persuasion? They get elected, they get to senior positions, but they seem to be very bad at it. And you're critical of both sides in this regard. But
that's the competition thing again.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in a heavy Democrat or Republican place, you probably just have to be the Republican or be the Democrat. Mm-hmm. And so you get in without having to be persuasive. But if you take somebody like Trump, I mean, he had to break the door down. Yeah. And he's the most persuasive human I've ever observed. Now, mm-hmm. of course, he's persuasive in two directions because the haters dig in even deeper. But in terms of how he changed people's minds, not just conservatives and Republicans, but the whole country and eventually the world, I don't think it's ever been matched, just in the ways he's made us think differently about so many different topics. So, I think the reason the politicians are bad is that they have never studied the art of persuasion and believe that it's common sense. And that's a big mistake, because your common sense is going to say, well, I think I'll lead with the facts and I'll be really rational. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. Whereas the people who know how to do it lead with hyperbole and anecdote and get your emotions going and scare you and show you visuals and that sort of thing. So I think people think they know how to do it, but they don't. Mm-hmm.
It's tough for someone like me, because I'm naturally, you know, I like nerds. I am very much interested in their arguments. But at the same time, you know, I'm someone who recognizes them, as much as I like Paul Ryan and I'm friendly with him. I also said, you know, he's never made an argument without a histogram. And unfortunately, that's the case for a lot of politicians, where, you know, the people that they've been in front of and had to convince on things are Chamber of Commerce types, or, you know, local businessmen who they want to give them money and that type of thing, instead of convincing large portions of the populace to agree with them about something. If you're looking at the 2024 lineup of people who are going to be running for president, of which there are many possibilities, just assume for the sake of argument that former President Trump does not run. What's the piece of how he was persuasive that could be best adopted by someone who isn't him? Meaning that they could wear it without seeming like they were, you know, putting on a Trump mask and trying to just ape him or pretend to be him.
Well, you know, the thing that he does that drives people crazy, that you're tempted to say is his flaw. Why does he have to do mean tweets? And that misses the fact that that is why he became president. It was his willingness to fight all the time about anything that mattered. That was attractive. People wanted a fighter, and they wanted a fighter on their side. So I don't, you'd have to be that level of fighter, but nobody can match the show. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump brings the show, so he can control all the energy. Like, he'd move the energy from any topic it was to whatever he's talking about. And I don't know that anybody has that skill to move all the energy, but DeSantis is doing the best job of it. Mm-hmm. Kind of taking a checklist of everything that would be popular with conservatives and just checking them off. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, they're going to like this. Boom, I'll do it. So he's the most clever politician right now in terms of putting together a package to, you know, be a presidential candidate. So if it's not Trump, I think DeSantis is the obvious nominee for the Republicans. I like Tom Cotton, especially for his China stance, but lots of other stuff too. I don't know if he's exciting enough, and I don't know if he can bring the hyperbole in a way that you sort of need to get elected president. But he's a solid choice, I think. But the real question is on the Democrat side.
Yeah.
What the hell? What the hell? give me one name. People are saying Susan Rice, but I don't know. Could she get elected? Maybe, if the Democrat machine is strong enough.
Well, it does seem like the Kamala experiment is looking worse and worse all the time. You mentioned China as it regards Tom Cotton. I know that you're someone who's been ahead of the curve on talking about China and China policy for some time. Why has it taken so long for so many leaders, particularly conservative leaders or hawkish leaders, though I don't like that term because it's so vague, to understand that the deals that we made with China ended up changing us in a lot of ways that we don't like, that we were importing their values along with their cheap TVs and the like, and be upfront about criticizing China when they are literally engaged in a cold war with us and importing drugs that are killing American citizens?
I think part of it is it's unbelievable. Meaning that if I told you, well, did you know that the country we do so much trade with is actually at war with us and killing tens of thousands of Americans every year with fentanyl and God knows what, now coronavirus, although I don't think that was part of any intentional plan. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at all the individual examples before you get the full picture. So it's a little like I always use the example of a bunch of people looking in different windows of a house and then trying to describe the house. And one person says, this house is a bathroom. It's where you go to the bathroom. Another one says, it's a kitchen because they're only looking in their one window. So I think that's always part of the problem. If you're looking at any one part of the China situation, you'd say, yeah, this is bad what they're doing with the intellectual property. And then you say, well, this is the topic. I'm looking at intellectual property. That's bad. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the whole package, it's clear that they're at war. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we can't say that out loud has something to do with diplomacy and something to do with stupidity, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think it has also something to do with the place near you, which is Hollywood. I mean, when I grew up as, a kid of the 80s and 90s, there were movie after movie, show after show that made clear that the Soviets were the bad guys. and like you knew who the bad guys were. Right. And now when you look around at Hollywood, it's people basically getting disappeared because they say something bad about China or they, whenever it's an actual Chinese citizen, they get nuked on the internet. When the studios clearly are very afraid of their power in terms of the marketplace. And that to me is an enormous amount of seething propaganda toward the idea that, these people are either too powerful to criticize or there's nothing to see here. And it's very troublesome to me. I don't know how that type of thing can even be changed. But it does seem to have seeped into our culture in a way that not even this pandemic seems to have changed. The sight of them lecturing our officials in the Alaska meeting a few months back was really disturbing to me, not just that they would be willing to use that language of critical race theory and the like, but that our own officials would be so poorly prepared for it.
The whole China situation, of course, makes me crazy. Some of your listeners might know that my stepson died from an overdose that included fentanyl. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, or 2018, actually. And since the fentanyl comes from China through the cartels, and we know that China knows who their dealer is, we know that because we told them. Mm-hmm. Here's his name and here's his address. go do something about this. And they just don't. Mm-hmm. So you know that part's intentional. And I take this whole China thing more personally than most.
We'll have more of my interview with Scott Adams right after this. One of the things that surprised me as someone who really only knew your work as a cartoonist before the pandemic, one of the things that surprised me about listening to you is you're actually a very tender-hearted person. you kind of wear your emotions on your sleeve. Has that always been the case for you, or is it something that has changed in recent years. It just, I don't know, it's kind of refreshing and very authentic, and comes across as being, you know, really honest and, mm-hmm. and almost soul bearing in a way that you don't typically hear from people who do podcasts, certainly not those known for making jokes about office work and the kind.
Yeah. You know, sometimes things become personal. So, mm-hmm. I think I'm just as, you know, just as surfacey as most people on most topics, but every once in a while something reaches in and, you know, just grabs you by the guts and doesn't mm-hmm. let go. So if you lose a son or a stepson, you don't really forget that.
Yeah,
that's personal and that's forever. So China has an enemy in me forever. But let me ask you a question.
Sure.
I always look for the dog that's not barking, you know, or listen for
yes.
it. Like, what's the thing that's not barking right now? And there's such a push for moving business out of China, you know, making things in America, et cetera. Where are the statistics on that? Because by now we should know how many American companies have decided to move into China in the past year or so. And we should know how many have moved out or how many have reduced their business. Shouldn't we have some statistics at this point? I mean, why is that just completely silent when I would argue it is the most important statistic in the world right now? Mm-hmm. Because feeding China will determine everything about the future.
I think there's an enormous factor politically here where people want to sound the note of the moment, but they don't actually want to do the work of highlighting companies, particularly in their own states, that have made these determinations one way or the other, because there's a lot of hypocrisy going on there.
Let me tell you, if the guy who makes the Dilbert cartoon finds out that your company just recently decided to move operations to China, good fucking luck to you. Because you're going to be really well known, really fast. And so if there's any CEO out there who doesn't think China is risky to do business, I'm going to make it risky for you. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about China. I'm going to give you plenty of risk personally.
Well, one of the things that's been an enormous driving factor here, I think, you know, and just to circle back to Hollywood, is, you know, the Disney company and the level of popularity that they have in terms of their products and in terms of the movies that they produce in China, and how concerned they are about, you know, running into problems. There's a reason that, you know, they kind of cut and frame the Marvel movies, the Star Wars stuff that they have in ways that are designed to avoid anything that could offend the Chinese. And I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of power there. There's a lot of money there that we ought to pay more attention to. But I think, you know, you're completely correct. This is a situation where we ought to be highlighting more and more the companies that are making decisions in a direction that goes against the American interest. And we have to ask, are you interested in being an American company or not? Which to me seems to be a pretty fundamental question for a lot of these tech companies that obviously, you know, are interested in that marketplace and are increasingly governing their own activity here in America as if they are creating social credit scores.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a big government guy, but one thing that the government can do that not everybody can do is just give you the right information. And mm-hmm. so that the citizens can make the right choice. The best example is that in banking, if you tried to get a loan in the old days, you couldn't really compare one loan to another because they had different features, and you just really couldn't tell which one's more expensive. So the government said, well, all banks have to do this thing called an APR calculation. So every loan can be compared to every loan, apples to apples. Mm-hmm. And that's like a great, great use of government. To me, that's the perfect use. And I'd love to see my government tell me what China is doing and what companies in America are moving to China, and let me make the decision. Mm-hmm. You know, government doesn't need to stop somebody from doing business in China. You just give us the information. We'll make it happen.
You said before that you have this optimistic bent about Americans. And I'm naturally hopeful myself about them, but I am also very much concerned that the lesson that we can take away from this past year and a half plus is that, you know, Americans are not as perhaps rebellious in mind as they used to be. I had a friend talk to me at the beginning of lockdowns last year, and he said, you know, he was concerned about conservatives and right wingers and anarchist types taking up weapons and having kind of violence in the streets from that angle. And I said that my concern was the opposite, that I thought, you know, I was scared that we would be docile, that we would just go along with everything, that we'd behave like sheep and wake up and find that we were in a country that where the government had a lot more power over us than it used to. Do you have any hope about that aspect of things? You know, you mentioned earlier the idea of, you know, 5 to 10% of people rebelling against something needing to be the difference maker here. But when I see, you know, Gretchen Whitmer putting, the tape around buying seeds and things like that, it makes me worry about the future in which we are made comfortable with sort of the permanent pandemic or permanent pandemic policy. What do you think about that?
You know, I think that what seems like meekness is probably ambiguity, meaning that I think the people who complain about, you know, whatever the government's doing about the pandemic, they're not entirely sure that it won't work or that it's not a good idea or that it's not a good idea for the short term. I think there's a lack of conviction. So, you know, if you're getting in a debate on Twitter, people are going to act like they're positive. It's like, I'm positive this doesn't work or that doesn't work. But they might not be positive enough to march in the street and, you know, risk their life for it. I think there are levels of how sure you are. So you might be absolutely sure that you have to kick out your despotic king and stop taxation without representation or something. But I'm not so sure everybody feels that they're the expert on the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I feel like people think, well, I definitely would have played it a different way, but I'm not so sure I'm right. And that does keep you from marching. But here's the optimism part. I don't think it's ever been that more than 10% of the public ever could be a rebel. That 10% might be able to co-opt the others over time. But I think 90% of us are, let me just live my life and politics is for other people and I'm not going to march unless you make me. So,
hey, I mean, a third of Americans were loyalists during the revolution. So, you know, I mean, it's by some estimates. You mentioned experts. The decline in American faith in institutions and in the expert class over the past couple of decades has been monumental. You can measure it in different ways, but when you look at polling data on the subject, there's just enormous distrust for virtually every institution of American life, you know, Congress and the media and the church and even sports leagues. Basically, the only thing that still rates well when it comes to trust is small businesses and the American military. But I don't know if that military rating is going to stay as high as it has been. The decline of trust in experts and elites, to me, is in the argument that I've made, is that it is earned, that their repeated failures with projected confidence have undermined them in a way that is historically really not really precedented in America. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there you go with the glass is half empty. Here's the glass full version with the same set of facts. We didn't lose our confidence or trust in the experts. We gained a greater awareness.
Yes.
So we're smarter. The experts didn't get dumber. Mm-hmm. They didn't start lying more. We just figured it out. Now, one of my best predictions ever, I think will always be underappreciated, is that when Trump was first running, I made the prediction a number of times in public that he was going to change more than politics, that he would change how we saw reality itself. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And imagine that call as a prediction, that one politician would change how you saw reality. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever did that before. And I told you that was going to happen, and here we are. So your reality of what you thought was real news versus fake news, even in terms of the percentage that was real versus fake, completely different now. Now, is that because the news turned fake? Maybe. or was it always a little bit fake, and we just weren't keyed into it before? And I think it's closer to the latter.
Yeah.
So I think that Trump just opened our mind, and the Trump experience, I think, opened our mind to the fact that people can make up a Russia collusion story, that could just be made up. Like, I'm not sure most people knew that that was even a thing, that you could just make up a whole complicated story about, you know, top leaders and with details and secret servers, and none of it's true. I mean, I'm not sure people thought that was even possible before, but clearly possible now.
Well, and to have that whole network, and I appreciate the social media accounts of journalists for letting us in to their mindsets on this, but to have that whole network of repetition and of one source being the same anonymous source used to back up the other anonymously sourced piece, you know, that we saw happen time and again. It was amazing to see it happen in real time. In terms of the elite sort of leadership class of the military, my brother, who's a big fan of yours and who is an Army officer, he really is frustrated by this, the top brass, the boomer generals, basically, as they are called by some, and their approach to leadership these past several years, and feeling that a lot of people who haven't really won anything are essentially as acting as politicians in order to protect their position, and that getting rid of them is an enormous problem, and has led, and their continued work has led to a real diminishment of the core, you know, mentality of officers in the military. What needs to happen in order to solve this problem? Do you have a solution that comes perhaps from the corporate world that would lead to clearing out a lot of this stuff and people who use woke politics to maintain their position?
Yeah, you're not going to like it, though. We need a war. because what, in principle, what could be more dangerous than a general who doesn't have a war? Because they got to do something, right? Like, general can't do nothing. It's like, oh, you stay ready, stay ready. That's not going to be enough. I mean, these are people who got to their position by being like ultra predator types, right? I mean, they're not steady state people. They got to do something. But what happens if there's no war? What are you going to do? You're going to have to find something to do to say you did something. That's one of my biggest complaints about corporate management, is you have to come to work every day if you're a manager. What if there's no problem that day? What are you going to do? And I feel like in the 90s, anyway, the managers were just making up stuff. It's like, well, how about this training course that's, you know, sold to us at great expense that says you'll all be better team workers when we're done? And of course, it'd just all be BS. So a general without a war is dangerous. And I don't know how to fix that except to give them a war. Because if you give them a war, they're going to work on what matters instead of what doesn't.
I'll go out on this. I listen to you or watch you drink coffee with such regularity, but I don't know how you make it or what you use. So how do you make your coffee in the morning, Scott?
Well, I had been using my Keurig coffee machine that's sort of built in. It's plumbed and everything. That's pretty cool. But lately I've been hooked on the Keurig because it makes my first cup faster. So that's an important detail for your listeners, the Keurig.
do you, what type of coffee are you drinking lately?
I'm sort of agnostic about coffee and food. I'm not a foodie or a flavor guy. In fact, I don't have COVID, but I lost my sense of taste and smell, 10 years ago or something, from just nasal polyps, nothing serious. But I don't really care about the coffee. If it gives me the buzz I need, I'm good.
Just a caffeine delivery device then. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for taking the time to join me today and to walk me through what's really going on in the world.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. I'm glad we solved everything today.
Obviously, one of the issues that has received so much attention in recent weeks is the dynamics at the border. The southern border has been a rolling disaster for the Biden administration, but it really does feel like this was the week or the past 2 weeks, a period where they could no longer deny the sheer level of chaos that is happening down there, given the fact that you had thousands upon thousands of Haitian migrants showing up and being placed under this bridge in Del Rio, creating some amazing scenes. And then, of course, you had the completely blown out of proportion fake news controversy about the idea that Border Patrol agents using their horses to try to corral these different migrants coming across the river were, in fact, whipping them. This is, of course, not true. The reporters on the scene said it was not true. The images and the video from the scene show that it isn't true. And yet, even the president of the United States, days later, was saying that he was going to make those people pay, meaning those Border Patrol agents, for what they had done. That's how corrupt we really have in terms of our conversation in most of the media today. John Davidson, who's our political editor over at The Federalist and who I've quoted before and had as guest on this program, had a piece over the weekend which talked about Biden's border policies. You can find it at The Federalist. President Biden's border policy is sheer horsepucky. What's the problem at the border? Is it the squalid migrant encampment under an international bridge in Del Rio, Texas, that grew to some 15,000 Haitians over the past week in what can only be described as a humanitarian disaster? Is it the ad hoc response of the Biden administration, which hastily deported hundreds of Haitians to Port-au-Prince, even as it released thousands more with nothing more than a request to report to federal immigration authorities within 60 days? Is it the ensuing chaos from such policies, which prompted a group of Haitian migrants in federal custody fearing deportation to forcibly take control of a bus that was transporting them to San Antonio and escape? Or, zooming out from the Haitian encampment, is it the record numbers of illegal immigrants being arrested along the southern border, which is on track to exceed 1.6 million this fiscal year, a new all-time record? According to the White House, it's none of these things. The real problem at the border, it seems, are the horses. I'm not kidding. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, who performatively decried images of mounted Border Patrol agents confronting illegal immigrants in Del Rio as horrible and horrific, announced Thursday that Border Patrol agents will no longer be allowed to use horses in Del Rio. Why? Because activists in the corporate press pushed a false narrative that the mounted agents were whipping migrants. They weren't. They were using split reins to control their horses and keep migrants from getting too close to the animals, as is standard practice. But it doesn't matter. Narrative triumphed over reality. Images of mounted Border Patrol agents trying to deter Haitians from illegally crossing the border triggered a moral panic in Washington. Rep. Maxine Waters declared that it was worse than slavery. A contingent of the Congressional Black Caucus marched down to the White House and issued a set of demands, including the banishment of horses from the border. Reverend Al Sharpton showed up in Del Rio, where he was reportedly shouted down by protesters. What had been a migrant crisis of the administration's own making was transformed overnight into a race issue. In the end, the race hustlers got the horses banned. What will banning horse patrols accomplish? Nothing, of course. It will only hamper the Border Patrol, which ingeniously uses horses to patrol dense riverbanks in rough country where SUVs and ATVs often can't go. To understand why the White House would ban horse patrols, you have to understand that the administration's entire approach to the border is pure theater. They are concerned with optics, not reality. So, for example, when images of a sprawling migrant encampment under a bridge in South Texas begin to dominate the news cycle, the overwhelming imperative is to clear the camp by any means available, even if it sows chaos and confusion, and even if it means telling bald-faced lies about what's going on there. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas kept insisting this week that the border was closed and that those who cross illegally will be deported. But of the 15,000 Haitians who were encamped under the bridge as of last Saturday, only about 1,400 have been deported. As of this writing, about 3,800 people remain at the camp, which means about 9,800 have been released into the United States since Saturday. Most of these people are being released with a notice to report, which is not the same as a notice to appear before an immigration judge, but a directive that the migrant, on his own initiative, contact an immigration office within 60 days to request a court date. If that's what the Biden administration means when it says it's securing the border, then I've got some horsewhips to sell them. The border policy is yet one more example, from my perspective, of how this president is failing in his approach. He's ran on the idea of being someone who was going to restore normalcy and order to a chaotic situation in Washington. In truth, he's done exactly the opposite, not just on the southern border, but in Afghanistan, not just within the conversation about fiscal policy in America, but the conversation about culture war issues as well. He's someone who is actually turning out to be an even bigger force for chaos and against norms than the media, corporate media ever claimed that Donald Trump was going to be. That's something that sets up a terrible situation for Democrats in the upcoming midterms. But it's going to require arguments from Republicans that go much further than simply criticizing this administration for failing to keep its promises. They have to offer an alternative vision of what the country ought to be doing and how it ought to approach these problems. It's not enough to criticize. You have to lead as well. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back next week with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.